This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this week for a preview of the trial of Ray Tensing and the fatal shooting of Sam DeBose, and to take a look at the other top local stories, our race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Kernute, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, local government and politics reporter Tom McKee, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tom, Mark, and Tana, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
You're welcome.
Former UC police officer Ray Tensing, he shot Sam DeBose during an off-campus traffic stop in July 2015. Tensing is claiming this was a case of self-defense. The prosecution has said really he could have avoided the situation in the first place. The trial gets underway on Tuesday, or at least elements of the trial, Tom. What's going to happen on Tuesday?
Well, what will happen on Tuesday is you're going to have jurors that have been pre-screened, that don't have problems, that don't have conflicts, whatever. About 200 of them are going to begin filling out questionnaires, jury questionnaires, questionnaires that have been agreed to by both sides of what are their views on law enforcement, what are their views on even Black Lives Matter, what are their views on a number of topics. The attorneys then will spend much of the rest of the week going over those, deciding who they would think they want on the jury, the jury selection process. Then starting the 31st of October in the courtroom of Judge Megan Shanahan, they will actually start questioning the people they would like to think about putting on the juror. And then testimony would probably start the first Monday in November. It's not going to be right away. So it's going to be a very slow jury selection process. The testimony then will unfold however long it takes. Judge Megan Shanahan, of course, has kind of set a deadline of trying to get finished by December 8th. That's her due date for a child she's going to have. So it's going to be a lot crammed into a very busy number of weeks.
Mark, the coverage on this case has been quite extensive. We've had the videotape of the confrontation between Ray Tensing and Sam DeBose viewed by a lot of people. So how tough is it going to be to find enough jurors who don't already have an opinion about this case?
That, I think, is the cliche of the $64,000 question. Just looking at what my colleague Kevin Grasha reported this morning, the pool as of this morning of potential jurors now stands at 234. You know, Tom just referenced it at that number. You know, I think that is going to just, as the calendar looks, is going to take a lot of time to find that. And Tana and I were both last week out at church in Roselawn at New Prospect Baptist, where they had a community forum which tried to explain the nuts and bolts of jury selection of, and those were some of the issues that came up, is there is a concern in the Black community of will there be a representative number of African Americans on that jury.
How unprecedented is a step like that, where you actually go out in the community and you're explaining things ahead of time like this for a case like this?
Well, it was hosted by the Black Lawyers Association of Cincinnati, and I did ask that question to their president, who was there, and she said, "Well, you know, we hadn't really heard about people doing this in other communities, but we really wanted to do it because as members of our association, we want to make sure that people of the African American community understand the process, because, you know, there is a lot of passion around this issue. We want to make sure people understand the law." And then they said, "If you disagree with that law, then you need to be educated on it. And Election Day is coming up, so go and vote, and that's how you'll make changes."
Now, who are the defense attorneys in this case, Mark?
Oh, goodness.
The defense attorney is Stu Matthews.
Stu Matthews.
And it'll be tried on the prosecution by Mark Pietmeyer and Mr. Gordon. Is that correct? Is that his last name?
I think so. But I mean, Joe Dieters.
If you can steer us along here, you know any of the names.
Yeah, Dieters. The other thing, Tana, I wanted to add real quickly is we were just speaking of this community event. I got word, the release came out this morning from the Black Lawyers Association. Second public event like that will be held Wednesday at Christ Emmanuel Christian Fellowship in Walnut Hills, Wednesday the 26th.
And that is correct. I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to educate the community as much as possible on what the process is in the legal community. You've heard the talk before. There shouldn't be a trial. He should be convicted and thrown in jail right now. Well, there's a process to go through. You have to have a jury of your peers. You have to have a prosecution that proves the case beyond a reasonable doubt by presenting evidence. And, of course, there have been 27 witnesses subpoenaed to testify once the testimony actually begins. The judge will give instructions. The charge, of course, we know is murder. That's what Joe Dieters and the grand jury came up with. There is a lesser-included offense that involves manslaughter. I believe it's involuntary manslaughter that the jury could consider as well. But there's an element in the community that won't be satisfied unless there's a conviction on murder. There's an element in the community that won't be satisfied unless he is completely acquitted. So is there a middle ground? What's the community reaction going to be? They're trying to educate the public on this trial process because it's not just a simple case of you go into court, he's convicted, he's put in jail. It's not that simple. It's a long, drawn-out process. That's a very technical and complicated situation.
Tom, did Ray Tensing's attorney ask for a change of venue out of concern over all the coverage that this has gotten?
Oh, certainly. He did early on, and I wouldn't be surprised even yet. There's a motion when motions are heard starting on Tuesday and the jury's questionnaires begin filling out. He may refile that again. The judge, to this point, obviously, with all the preparations that have gone, the judge has said, no, we believe we can get a fair and impartial jury right here in Hamilton County and conduct the trial here. So as of right now, this trial remains at the Hamilton County Courthouse.
Right. Technically, I believe that motion hasn't actually been heard yet, but what Tom says is correct, that the likelihood of it being moved is nil. In fact, I did some research and asked around and talked to the law library and everything, and the best that we can find is in 1899, there was an application for a trial to be moved from Hamilton County to Warren County. It was denied, but it was ultimately heard in Butler County. And as far as anybody can find or know, that's the last time and only time a trial's been moved.
Really?
Yeah.
I find that to be rather surprising it's been that long, Tana.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Tom, tell us a little bit about the judge in the case, Megan Shanahan.
Well, Megan Shanahan is serving out her first term as a judge. She is up for re-election. She was an assistant prosecutor in Hamilton County before she became a judge. I have not seen the judicial ratings that have come out by the Bar Association, whether she's recommended or highly recommended. But from everything I've seen in the trials that I've covered, she's very methodical. She's very decorum-oriented. She's very legal-minded. She's very fair. In the cases that she's handled, she seems to conduct herself in a very professional manner, and she's going to do so, I think, in this case, because she and the rest of the community know that this is a very important case for the entire community.
Yeah, there's a lot on the line here.
Country.
Yeah. Speaking of that, Tom, and maybe Mark, you have some perspectives on this too. How much national attention is this case expected to get?
I think again is these types of police-involved shootings have happened, involving African-American citizens. They continue to happen around the country. And I think with social media, with people having smartphone video, what people tell me in the neighborhoods is that, something may happen in Baton Rouge or suburban Minneapolis, St. Paul, but they all have a sense that they're local. And all of these cases are attracting national attention, and I'm not sure, we haven't heard, but from what I understand, there will be a significant national media presence at this trial.
Tom, what have you heard on that?
Well, certainly when Mr. Tensing was brought into court initially for his initial court appearance, CNN was here, Fox was here, ABC, NBC, CBS, all the networks were here. I can remember conferring with Tom Yamas of ABC News during that particular thing. So I have no reason to believe that they won't have some sort of presence, maybe not during the entire trial, but they'll certainly be aware of what's going on.
Now, so the judge in this is close to her due date. What happens if she has the baby, say, mid-trial? Does everything go back on hold until she comes back? Does anybody know how that would work?
I do not. Now, I had heard what we were told was that she's thinking the longest the trial would go is November 18th. So Tom said December 8th. That was new to me.
We had heard November 18th as well.
Okay, well, that would be good for the entire situation then. But I think every precaution has been taken to try to make sure that things are taken care of in the professional manner that this community wants, deserves, and needs before the expected mother delivers her newborn baby.
Can I jump in with a question here? At the forum that Mark and I were at last week, Sam DeBose's mother kind of asked a question that hinted at the fact that it sounded like she was worried the video may not be allowed to be shown to the jury. Is there any question of that the video will be dismissed as evidence, wouldn't be allowed as evidence?
Tom, I'm going to bounce that one to you. I hadn't heard that yet.
I have not heard that yet at all, but certainly motions are possible on anything, to exclude evidence, to add evidence, that sort of thing. That's what the lawyers are going to argue in court, I'm very sure. I had not heard that. I can't believe there would be too many people that haven't seen that particular video and haven't at least concluded in their minds what they see on that video. But that's where the interpretation comes in from the prosecution, what they see. That's where the interpretation of the defense comes in as to what they see, and then what they can convince the jurors that is the right interpretation to be applied to the case, to be applied to the law in this case. What I think, or what Mark thinks, or what Tana thinks, or what community members thinks about that particular video has no bearing whatsoever. It's only what's going to be in that courtroom that really is going to count.
And just to be clear, I'm not saying that I had heard anything or that that may even be a question. It just seemed to be something that was maybe in the back of Mrs. DeBose's mind. So I just wanted to put that out there as a question for us today.
Right. And she also at that forum, you know, stood up with one of her attorneys, Al Gerhardstein, and asked the question of the panel of the legal experts, you know, why is there even need for a trial with the video? And I think that kind of articulates, you know, not just her family's perspective, but I think the perspective of a great number of people in the black community.
Well, you look at the video, and Stu Matthews has said on many occasions, Officer Tensing's contention is that he was dragged, that he was in danger when this all occurred. He's going to try to prove that point with witnesses. Perhaps Mr. Tensing himself will take the stand. That's always a interesting point to determine whether there will be the defendant or whether there won't be the defendant actually on trial. He doesn't have to testify under our legal system. The prosecution's burden is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty of murder or this other lesser included offense.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us this week for a preview of the trial of Ray Tensing and the fatal shooting of Sam DeBose, and to take a look at other top local stories, our race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Kernute, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, local government and politics reporter Tom McKee, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Tana, what kind of restrictions is the judge putting in place for this particular trial?
In terms of who's allowed in the courtroom, well, the courtroom is not very large. It holds, I think the fire capacity is about 86, 83 people. So, and that includes, you know, the judge and all of the court staff,
all the attorneys,
deputies, and everybody.
Yes.
So basically, once you take all of the people that have to be there for the trial out, it'll get divided into fourths. So the prosecution will have a fourth of the remaining seats. The defense gets a fourth, you know, both sides for family members. A quarter will go to the media, and then a quarter is left for the public because it is a public trial and the public is allowed to be there. And so that the sheriff estimates will probably be around 20 seats. And I understand there'll be a kind of a daily lottery for those seats. There's an overflow viewing space in courtroom B of the Justice Center that'll hold about 60 to 100 where people, if they want to go down and watch it there, you're welcome to do that. Now, the sheriff's office is also encouraging, this is going to be live streamed on all the networks, at least on their websites. They encourage it, you know, to maybe gather in your church congregations or in your homes and watch there as well. In terms of other restrictions, the media will be in there. It will be live streamed. As I said, there will be a still photographer as well. There will be media in the courtroom. There's an overflow media area for all of the coverage concerns.
Tama, what kind of preparations have local authorities been making for this?
Well, Sheriff Jim Neal and Major Charmaine McGuffey of the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office had a news conference yesterday going over much of what Tana has talked about, but they also talked about security inside the courthouse, security outside the courthouse. They didn't give specifics, but there'll be a heavy security presence. I know the media, for instance, I'm going to be required to have a badge that has WCPO on it. I'm going to have my driver's license available, too. They want two forms of identification. Some of the fifth floor where this courtroom is are going to be restricted.
Yeah, the whole floor is going to be restricted.
There'll be patrols around the building as well, and that's the sheriff's office. Now, when you get off to the sheriff's office, to the city streets, that's Cincinnati Police Department's territory. And Lieutenant Steve Saunders, the public information officer for the Cincinnati Police Department yesterday, told me that they're not going to give specifics either. They're going to be monitoring the situation. They're going to continue to communicate with all parties involved. They're going to continue to have a dialogue with the community as to what's going on, the ebb and flow of what's going on with community leaders, with religious leaders, with faith-based leaders, with other stakeholders. And then they're going to be ready to act if needed. The anticipation by many is that there won't be a problem. There won't be any civil unrest or disturbances. There may be protests, and that's fine with the sheriff's office, but all those will happen outside the courthouse. Nothing will be allowed inside the courthouse or in any other county building that is controlled or monitored or security provided for by the sheriff's office. What they want to remind people is also, this is not the only trial going on in the courthouse. There are other municipal courts. There are other common pleas courts that have proceedings that are going to be going on during this time as well. And those people need to be able to move in and out of the courthouse and also to be protected just as much as everybody in the Tensing case is going to be protected, just as much as anybody who wants to protest outside is going to be protected as well, the right to free speech.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Jeannie downtown. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I had a question. I don't know. Before the incident happened, was there some law with UC officers where they only patrol a certain perimeter up at UC, and if they felt like they needed to stop someone but the person drove outside the perimeter, then they would have to contact Cincinnati police officers? Was that a rule before this happened?
I do remember reading some of the material just after this. Was the police department, as we learned later from the University of Cincinnati, had a very aggressive policy under the former chief of making traffic stops to try to control crime around the campus. In this particular case, the stop was made, I believe, near the intersection of Vine and McMillan, and then Mr. DeBose was followed down into Mount Auburn, down Vine Street, and then up Phil Street, and up under a couple of other streets that were off campus. I believe, and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the protocol was to have Cincinnati contacted as well, in addition to University of Cincinnati officers, if they were to make a stop.
What I recall reading that some of my colleagues reported, and I think came out in the weeks after the shooting, was the previous administration of the UC Police Department had what was called a no-fly zone, which was patrol of that area surrounding campus, where approximately, I think they estimate, about 13,000 UC students live in off-campus housing. And there had been always the perception of those areas being high crime. So there was an aggressive stance of traffic stops as a way to control crime, to monitor who is coming in and out of those communities. And there was a, from what I understand, an agreement in principle with the city of Cincinnati of a kind of a prescribed geographic area that the UC Police Department would patrol.
Mark, what's the stance of the UC Police Department become on patrolling off campus since the shooting?
It is now one of high visibility, but no traffic stops. And it's we actually had a meeting this morning with some of the officials from the UC Police Department, and have pointed to 15-year lows in violent crime or in the area around campus.
And, of course, we have to realize, too, that they have changed their policing procedures quite a bit. New Chief Anthony Carter is in place. A new Assistant Chief Maris Harold is in place. A new Safety Director Jim Whalen is in place. And now Robin Engel is the Vice President of Safety and Reform. And they've just released a six-point plan that's kind of like a mini collaborative agreement like Cincinnati has for how they're going to conduct everything in the future in a transparent manner. So what you saw before when Sam DeBose was stopped by Ray Tensing and then this incident happened, the culture is, I think, dramatically different now than it was in July 2015.
And UC would say they have the numbers to point that out. Robin Engel yesterday listed out from January 1 to July 31st of 2015, the same period to 2016, arrests are down off campus. There are down 69%. Citations are down 95% in terms of, well, arrests and citations. You know, 935 citations January 1 to July 31st, 2015. 43 January 1 to July 31st, 2016.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Lawrence in Price Hill joins us now. Hi, Lawrence.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, my comments or questions are based on this premise that recently, well, not even recently, in the last several years in shootings where involved officers and citizens, the men that were killed were done so with the justification or this notion that the officer was in fear for his life. My question is this. First of all, what is the definitional definition of murder? Does it include intent? And if not, can Officer Tensing get away with this by saying, oh, I was in fear for my life, even though he was the only one with a weapon?
Well, murder would imply intent. The secondary charge here is voluntary manslaughter, which takes out kind of the intent.
And that's an option the jury can consider in the case.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And that would carry 3 to 11 years. Now, in terms of the question of I was in fear for my life, as they explained at this forum that we were at last week, there is a higher threshold that police have to meet, a higher expectation
than a civilian would have to meet.
To give you the legal definitions of those, I'm sorry, I can't do.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. But self-defense is an claiming self-defense is an affirmative defense in a court case. So if Tensing can prove that he was in fear of his life and shot in self-defense, if he can meet the higher standards that you're talking about, Tana, that police officers have to meet, then I would take it that it wouldn't still be murder at that point. So
I mean, that would be what Stu Matthews presumably will argue.
Yeah. Right. Stu Matthews has already said that Tensing fired the shot because he feared for his life when DeBose allegedly began to drive away from the traffic stop.
And as Tom was pointing,
and he's continually maintained that he was in some way, shape, or form dragged. So that we'll see how that plays out. We'll see if the evidence backs up that statement when we go to trial.
Well, and Tom, as you were pointing out earlier, the burden of proof is on the prosecution. So the defense only has to create the doubt in the jurors' minds. So they have a little bit easier job than the prosecution does, I would think.
That would be correct. Stu Matthews is excellent as a defense attorney for any client that he represents, and I'm sure that the expert witnesses that he's going to bring in would certainly try to counter any expert witnesses that Joe Dieters and Mark Pietmeyer and Rick Gibson would bring in. It's going to be a trial of experienced lawyers arguing on behalf of their client, and it's up to those 12 people and the two alternates. It's up to those people in the jury box to decide which version of events is the right version.
Jean in Mount Airy joins us now. Hi, Jean.
Hi. My question or comment is, and this is not judging who's right or who's wrong, but simply the question is, so many of these incidences, including the Sam DeBose, if they had simply done as the police officer asked them to do, it probably would not have escalated. He was asked for his driver's license how many times? All he had to do was produce it, and that could have avoided this whole situation.
I have heard a lot of conversations about that very same point, that police officers in general would say, or people in the community would say, obey a police officer, deal with it at that particular moment, you can always work out whatever problems might be happening later on. Mark, correct me if I'm wrong. Tana, correct me if I'm wrong. I do not believe DuBose was able to produce a license despite the repeated requests, correct?
That's what I just watched the video, the beginning part of that video again yesterday, and he seemed to be indicating that he didn't have it on him. It was at his home, which, you know, he was on his way to.
I think the general a line of thinking among many African Americans that I've spoken with, and I've been to a different community events and church events, is that even if he didn't comply exactly, and this is the case that you hear from, whether it's shootings in Tulsa or Charlotte or many other areas, that the perspective in the community is, even if he didn't comply, does that mean it has to rise to the point of him being shot in the head? And there's been cases that have been, you know, come out, you know, from legitimate media sources of white perpetrators having a gun, threatening police, and they're subdued without fatal use of force. So, again, it's the judge, the jury. The jury is going to be looking at this very isolated incident. But as we spoke earlier, there is so much national overlay and multiple layers to this story, you know, that deal to the heart of the whole issue of race and equality in our country.
Mark, have you heard how the DuBose family is preparing for this trial? Are they actually going to be at the trial, or what are they planning at this point?
Well, from what we understand, we were at the courthouse. Myself and a couple of my photojournalist colleagues were outside of the courthouse a week ago today for the first pretrial hearing. And his Sam DuBose fiance came in with, and we saw a couple of his children as well. So from what we understand, you know, the family will have a presence at the trial.
The son, Aubrey DuBose, when I spoke with him, said he, his mother, and two sisters intend to be in the courtroom.
Hmm. What is the mood of the community, Mark, as we're entering into this trial? What have you been seeing?
You know, I think what we learn is we work on these types of stories, and we have, you know, are fortunate enough to have experience in the neighborhoods, is there's not a single monolithic attitude. You know, there's a sense among some that because there was the large financial settlement with the family from the University of Cincinnati, that there is an element of justice that has been done, or some admission of wrongdoing, you know, with the, you know, the approximately $5 million settlement. Again, as you mentioned earlier, Mark and Tom, you know, there's people out there in the community that will not be satisfied unless, you know, Ray Tensing goes to jail. And as Tana said, you know, for the voluntary manslaughter charge, it's a 3 to 11 year sentence without gun specifications, which would have added 3 years to either end of that. So, you know, the mood is one of anxiety, apprehension. There's a lot at stake, and I think it rises up with a lot of young African Americans, especially young Black men. You know, the whole idea of the apprehension of being pulled over for quote unquote driving while Black.
Shakura in Mount Auburn joins us. Good afternoon, Shakura.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
First of all, I don't know who the gentleman was that just expound so elegantly about the perspective of Black citizens as it pertains to the encounters with the police officer. But I got to say
that
this.
Would
I
be
just
Mark
want to
Knut.
Thank you because, okay, Mark, I want to thank you for that because that's not a perspective. That's the reality. Because no matter when it's someone's being pulled over, it shouldn't end in the end result should always be death. So let me say thank you for that. And my question wanted to ask you guys, if y'all know, there was another officer involved. He collaborated initially with Tinson's story. So therefore he was on record saying that, yeah, these things didn't happen. And then all of a sudden it got backtracked and no longer do we hear about this guy. And I was just wondering, when it's all over and done, is there any grounds for the family to file any kind of civil suit against this officer? Because this is what happens a lot. The officer who does whatever they do gone to trial, but then there's other people around this officer who collaborated with their story, and we never hear about that. And I just, you know, we know how society works. If me and you or whoever else on the panel was to do a crime, they get me and you guys all of a sudden back out of it. Somewhere down the line, they can still charge you guys, and it just don't seem like it always happened with the officers. Like, they get one, but then the other guys get escaped.
Yeah.
Sure. So this was just addressed by Jim Whalen, who, as Tom was saying earlier, the former police chief, from a captain, I believe, from Cincinnati, who now works for UC. There were two other officers who showed up on the scene. Forgive me for not remembering their last names offhand, but they showed up as the event, right as it was kind of happening, so they're seeing it from behind. And when the police came on the scene right after the event had happened, they said what happened, and Ray Tensing said, you know, I was dragged or whatever it was, and one police officer said, I saw that, and the other officer said nothing. So then when they went back and were asking them, well, what did you see? And he said, and this was before the video came out, you know, he explained what he saw. And so they went back and they said, you know, he didn't sort of try to corroborate or lie is what they said. But he just said, you know, after Tensing described what, you know, he said, I saw that, meaning I saw the car start to roll away. I saw you shoot. I saw you, you know, fall or whatever. All he said was, I saw that. And the other officer said nothing.
Real quickly, Mark, revisiting your earlier question about the mood of the community, you know, this case and the potential that colleagues of Ray Tensing's corroborated or were going to corroborate his story, even under kind of questionable circumstances, is one of the reasons civil rights groups from the NAACP to the National Action Network to it's everyone and many in the community are so adamant about the use of body cameras, because the sense is that the body camera video from this incident, you know, dismissed or disproved what Tensing's colleagues were saying, you know, that there was that this instead of it being another case where you had three potential for three police officers saying this is what happened, it's a much more complicated case and offers an additional perspective because of the body camera. So you're not limited to taking the word, again, and not to disrespect or discredit police officers, but again, it provides additional information that otherwise wouldn't have been available.
And you can read about that incident if you go to UC's website. The whole incident is kind of laid out. It's either in the Exeter report or the Kroll report. You can search those both on UC's website and read the whole explanation of that.
And Tom, go ahead.
There was some sentiment in the community to this gentleman's question was, why were these officers charged or disciplined with a crime? Well, Jim Whalen, as Tana was saying, explained it because this is what he saw. He's not saying right or wrong. This is what he saw. You can't discipline, or he didn't violate any department procedures by just relating what he saw. Whether that backs up or doesn't back up Officer Tensing, that's not the issue. This is what I saw. This is my statement. Will it be challenged in court? I think there's no doubt it will be challenged in court. Could the family file a suit against these officers? That's up to a higher power. That's up to Mr. Gerhard Stein or some of the other legal team, Michael Wright, or some of the other legal team that have been advising the DeBose family throughout this case.
But Tom, have you heard anything specific about the family might file the suit if, depending on what happens with the case?
No, I haven't heard anything that would be credible at this particular point, no.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Dave in Blue Ash. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to see if your guests had any information about how what's going on to keep UC officers off of Cincinnati streets and out of the neighborhood. I think one of the most disturbing parts about this case is that a UC officer shot someone who wasn't a student, wasn't an employee, wasn't a faculty member, had nothing to do with UC. And I think it's pretty scary that we have UC cops that essentially have, you know, similar police powers to state police.
Yes, so as we were saying earlier, UC is still patrolling in that half-mile-to-mile radius around campus because they have 12,000 to 13,000 students that live in that you know, kind of square range of the two campuses there in the Clifton area. But they have changed their policing tactics. You know, the city of Cincinnati City Council kind of revoked the right of them to make traffic stops. So as Mark was saying, they're just there to be
highly visible.
They're using less abrasive tactics and different strategies.
And to that extent, there's also been extensive modifications and changes to the training of UC police officers. That is, continuing education in line with major municipal departments, which include implicit bias, constitutional training, less aggressive, more community-based, community-oriented policing. To try to rebuild or begin to rebuild some of the relationship in those neighborhoods where you do have a mix of, as this gentleman was just saying, non-students living among a great number of UC students.
Mark, have you heard anything from people? I know the collaborative agreement applies to the city of Cincinnati, but have you heard from any community leaders who say, it really helped to have that framework in place, helped us with this whole situation?
Well, I think you could go back to last year, just in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, where from Mayor Cranley on down, he credited the existence of the collaborative agreement for helping, maintain order and prevent violence. But, the perspective that many other people have is that really what probably kept and prevented violence or civil unrest to some degree was Joe Dieter's news conference, where he announced the charges and was very direct and adamant about what he saw on the videotape, and used very, as Joe Dieters as often will do, very direct, kind of no holds barred language to describe what he saw on that videotape, and then made the pledge or the statement that he would personally prosecute the case.
Tom, before we let you go, any final thoughts?
I think you cannot underestimate the amount of planning and behind-the-scenes work that's been going on with community leaders, faith-based leaders, city leaders, police agencies. They're talking back and forth. They're trying to create a dialogue of, let's keep things calm. Whatever happens in this case, that's what the justice system is going to do. Let's let the cooler heads prevail in all of this. And that's what everybody's crossing their fingers for. And, of course, they're planning for what ifs.
And the family has really kind of made a plea for calm, for peace. They want people to be heard. They obviously want justice for their son and their brother. But they said he's a peaceful man, and we want anything attached to his name to have that peaceful. We don't want Ryan. In fact, the brother, Aubrey DeBose, said, he and Sam, they were rappers. They would sing songs and talk. He said, we're all about talking and debate.
And again, even going up to the city manager in a conversation I had with him earlier this week, just talked of the exhaustive measures the city was taking to communicate and have open dialogue back and forth, which, and Tom went down the list of the other parties.
And Tom, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, local government and politics reporter Tom McKee. Mark Carnute and Tana Weingartner will join us in the next part of the show. We will continue with a look at the other top local stories of the week, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us this week for a look at the top local stories, our race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Carnute, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor, Tana Weingartner. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Doug in Oakley joins us. Doug has one question related to the Ray Tensing trial. So, Doug, go right ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. My question is this. I'm not sure whether Tensing had a police, carried a police commission, which would entitle him as to make a stop, at least most definitely in a felony situation anywhere within the jurisdiction. However, I guess my question is this. I wonder if, even if he did carry a police commission, Would that have negated the possibility of him stopping DuBose in a minor misdemeanor or just traffic stop situation?
So all police officers on the UC police police force have gone through peace officer training. They go through the same police academy that regular police officers go through. So they do have the training. Did you want to add?
Well, no, that, yeah, for the Ohio.
Yeah, they're full-fledged
peace
officers.
Yeah. It's the same as Cincinnati or Columbus
right.
or Cleveland.
And they do get a little bit of ongoing training. Now, do they get the full extensive training that that Cincinnati police officers get? Because Cincinnati does that extra training and more that was part of that collaborative agreement. They don't quite get that same thing. But Cincinnati, UC is implementing new training and strategies and sensitivity strategies.
Without question, what the difference that we understand prior to this incident was that while they had the advanced training ahead of, you know, as they went through the academy, they did not receive the ongoing
right.
training that, say, Cincinnati officers have been receiving since the collaborative agreement.
So I think his question revolved around, does a UC police officer have the jurisdiction to pull someone over off campus?
They did at the time, definitely.
Now, shifting gears here, Mark, you had an interesting story. The Association of Black Cincinnati Police Officers, the Sentinels, they're unhappy with some political endorsements the FOP has made. So tell us what that's about.
Well, you know, I think it was September 16th that came out that the National Fraternal Order of Police, which has about 330,000 members nationally, came out and endorsed Donald Trump for president. And the Sentinels is an organization that's of approximately 230 African-American officers. It is not a union. It is an association. It is still represented in bargaining by the FOP. But the FOP had a meeting prior and included, from what I understand from my sources, a number of white retirees. And there was a floor vote by standing whom they wanted to endorse for president, which was not an endorsement by the Cincinnati Lodge of the FOP.
They were just saying they were following what the national...
They were contributing up the chain, you know, kind of contributing that the Cincinnati Lodge, that they had a, you know, a floor vote, which, again, went into the, from what I understand, contributed to the kind of the pooling of the national endorsement. The Sentinels, again, being African-American, came out and Officer Eddie Hawkins, who's the president of the Sentinels, he and I spoke at length yesterday. And he was at the meeting, said not one African-American in that meeting stood up. And he has gone on record saying that, you know, the Sentinels as an organization do not agree with that endorsement and feel that law enforcement should not be involved in politics. The FOP locally, however, in August had endorsed a number of state, congressional, and local candidates in races, most of whom were incumbents, including Hamilton County Sheriff Jim Neal. But again, this, I think, speaks to the larger issue that is overlaying the Tenzing trial, the political, the presidential election, is that there is racial tension, you know, very palatable and very real in this country at this point and in our city.
Matt Hawkins, in this case, he's not, and the Sentinels aren't really complaining about Donald Trump per se. He was the catalyst for this whole thing. They're just saying we shouldn't be endorsing anybody, period, even in local races.
On the record, yeah, he said we don't belong in politics. That was a quote he gave me. And then he did go to say further with everything going on, you know, we need to stay neutral politically. And again, he did reference the Tenzing trial, the racial overlay intentions that are related to that. And again, just emphasize the need of both the reality and the perception of neutrality by law enforcement.
So they sound like they're basically taking the same stand as members of the military. No political endorsements.
Exactly. Again, it's a police being a paramilitary organization itself. You know, I think you could maybe, again, this is my perspective, you could possibly read between the lines and look, I don't have the latest poll numbers in front of me, but, you know, majority of African Americans polled are not supportive of Donald Trump.
What's been the response from the local FOP president, Dan Hills? What has he had to say about all this?
I spoke with him briefly about this, and he said that the FOP, the local FOP, does not get involved in presidential politics, but yet they did do, like I said, the other candidates for statewide and congressional offices.
So again, it's just the case they're saying we're just following this up the chain on the Donald Trump endorsement. The national folks did it. We're just reaffirming it.
Well, no, I think it was kind of the local was done ahead of time as kind of a feeder into the larger thing of kind of an informal, hey, we did a floor vote. Our members are supportive of Donald Trump, and that got kicked up to the state and then to the national level.
Tana, the latest strategy from Hamilton County officials on dealing with the heroin epidemic, they started a program, I think it was either late August, early September, somewhere back in that time
about
frame.
September 7th or
was
so,
it?
I think.
Okay, where they were actually trading immunity for drugs. So what's going on with
right,
this?
Right, so the prosecutor, the sheriffs, the coroner, other leaders all went to a county judge and asked, can we use the strategy of offering immunity to friends, loved ones, family members of people who are heroin addicts or whatnot, that if they find this and they want to help their addicted, loved one, if they turn in that that product, can you offer them immunity, so you don't walk in and get arrested for
right.
having that stuff? With the idea being...
Don't get charged with possession or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Yeah. With the idea being that, at that time is when the heroin epidemic was breaking out and we're finding it's laced with that carfentanil, the animal tranquilizer. That was just, so potent that people were overdosing and still are, I guess, kind of left and right. And, it's kind of a dramatic strategy to do something about that. Can we offer immunity to just get that product off the street? So that's, the judge, okay, he said, all right, for that. And then just, I believe this week.
How's it working so far?
This week we finally have the first case where somebody took them up on that offer and came in with a bunch of paraphernalia. That they had taken some needles, pipes, that kind of stuff that they had taken from their loved one. I'm not sure if they had been asked to kind of hold it for them or the friend knew where it was, but they took it and brought it in.
But after 1 month, you get your first case of somebody turning in something drug-related.
Right.
When they started this, were they expecting a little bit more activity than this?
I think that they were maybe hoping it was something that they hadn't tried before, but they, they've used this concept of immunity for other things to get other, to bring other information or things forward. So, we've tried it over there. Why not try it over here?
Mark, what do you think about this? How effective do you think a program like this can end up being?
I think there's, again, immunity is a powerful thing. And I'm not completely up to speed on it. I was involved 3-4 years ago when we first started covering the heroin and opioid epidemic. Again, so much of my work is in the Black community, and I think the perspective I would bring that I hear from sources and people I speak with regularly is that heroin is a disease. It's mainly a white issue among white people. But 20, 25 years ago, when crack cocaine was the scourge of the Black community, it was a crime, and there was 3 strikes out, and it was illegal, and it was breaking the law, and it was criminal. And now heroin is a disease. And so I think there's, again, going back to that whole issue of racial tension, that's kind of what you're seeing, is no one was offering immunity 25 years ago if you brought
right.
in crack cocaine.
Yeah. And Tana, as far as this is just one tool of many. And trying to deal with this,
right,
this heroin epidemic.
And, it, perhaps now that somebody's taken it up on them, if there was some concern, how truthful is that going to be? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll come in with my drugs. Uh-huh. Now that maybe they've seen it, maybe there's a little more,
Hope will follow.
On there. Yeah.
Well, Tana and Mark, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Race and Communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Knuth, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor, Tana Weingartner. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.